Let's resume and try to conclude today our discussion of the two-dimensionalizing model. So yesterday, or last Friday, we computed the partition function of the 2D-izing model on a square lattice. And the result, which was an exact result, was that there was a prefactor. This prefactor, I remind you, this just comes from writing that exponential of beta as I as j is not exactly 1 plus v as I as j, which is what we use because we have empty and one stick, but there is some normalization here. And this normalization happens once per L squared, so this gives to this factor here. It's trivial, but it's kind of important if you want to write a full result.
I think that's the
minus sign. Yeah, there is a minus sign, yeah, that's right. Because it's cosh here, and cosh is 1 minus tangent squared, so precisely there is a minus sign. right? Then we add this exponential of minus logarithm with a 1/2 because we have two orientations for our paths, minus because we were weighting the paths with minus 1 to the winding plus 1, and the plus 1 is this minus here. And finally, when we sum the paths with the winding, we end up computing a determinant, right? A determinant of identity matrix minus V times some transfer matrix T, which is a 4x4 matrix. And therefore, this is a polynomial of degree 4 in V, which is what is inside the log, right? So at least it looks okay, right? We did not compute this determinant because it's a 4x4 determinant. It's something one does in a computer in the privacy of one's home. But this would be the correct result. Okay. Then we saw that if this result behaves in an interesting way when we are close to a critical value, and this value is 1 minus square root of 2. So what's the critical value? So these cosines can be at most 2 if q is 0, then cosine of 0 plus cosine of 0 is 2. Can be, at the biggest they can be is 2, the smallest they can be in absolute value is 0, right, at the boundary of the Brillouin zone. And so, in the middle of the Brillouin zone, and at the boundary they can be 2. The dangerous point is 2, because 2 is when this term can fight this one and lead to a 0 of the log. And so we expand it around small q, we get q squared, and we see that indeed the result can vanish if we are close to the critical temperature, which is 1 minus square root of 2, right? Which is determined precisely for this equation to be true. And indeed, we call it a critical temperature, but then we should compute some physical quantity that exhibits a critical behavior there to be able to call it a critical temperature. And we gave an example. We said if this is true, then the partition function is something regular when t goes to tc, plus such type of logarithmic contribution, which is also regular because if t goes to tc, this vanishes faster than this. But this log is here, and at some point, if you take enough derivatives, at some point you will wake up this monster. And indeed, if we take two derivatives to compute, say, the specific heat, when the derivatives kill this prefactor, I get a logarithmic divergence, so it really shows that the specific heat has a spike, so it's something that you would measure in the lab. You would start changing your temperature, and you would see that close to the critical temperature, I change the temperature a little bit, and that's enough to increase the energy a lot. You would really see a critical behavior in your experiment. Right? Notice that q equal to 0 is exactly saying that the contributions that are contributing, the terms that are contributing are long wavelengths. Right? So it's long wavelength, so it's really when the system is approaching a critical temperature, the correlation length is becoming very large, and it's the long wavelengths that are contributing, right? It's those that are, which is exactly what we expect. Okay, so let's make a few comments. So the first, let's make a few comments. One is, what about d bigger than 2? So there is a natural, you could imagine that given this very simple result, that we could just, well, it looks really inspiring, right? We sum up to 2, we have D2Q, let's just put D3Q and sum up to 3 and try to guess more or less the result. Okay? So this, indeed, people tried actually to do it, but it doesn't work. So the solution for DB equals to 2 is not known. Okay? So the model is not yet solved. So it's an open problem to solve the 3D Ising model on a cubic layer. So we know something about the model in the critical point. We have lots of numerics for the solution of the 3D Ising model, but we don't have an analytic expression like we have for the 2D Ising model. Okay? So that's simply not known. You could ask, what about D equals 2 and non-zero magnetic fields? And the answer is, again, it's not known. But here I would like to say a few words about this. So you see that if you have a magnetic field, the first thing we observe is that now we have no longer just closed paths. If you go to your derivation in terms of sticks, now we have an explicit e to the h times sj, right? And therefore, you can think that this, if you think of this as some constant plus some other constant times sj, right? Because this only takes 2 values, so I can fix these constants for this to be true. Usual thing. Then we are saying that at each site, we either put nothing or we put a source, right? Which is what the magnetic field does. It's sourcing the spin. And so now we no longer have just closed paths. Now in our lattice, we would have closed paths. They are still there. But we also have, say, we source. We insert one of these terms from the magnetic field. So this would be this term here. We source another in another place, another term, and we insert a path between the two. So this would be another type. Now we would think that we will have paths, but we also have sources at random places. And at the sources, it's beginning for the path. And so we have this kind of Z of sticks, but also of these sources. Right? And when we have a source, we need an odd number of sticks ending there. Odd number of sticks. So it's a little bit like a gas of closed and open strings at the same time. And this partition function was never solved. Okay, so this is harder to solve, and this guy is not solved. But it's clear that this is the type of model we would get, right? It just so turns out that this was not so. However, a few things are known. A few things were solved. And a few things you can compute along this language. And we could compute the expectation value of spin at position I and spin at position j. So this is more complicated than that, but this is known. And in particular, let's discuss a few formulas from this result. This is in the second reference. I'm now going to pick the second reference there, and I'll tell you what chapter it is. But it's a section where he computes this correlation function as ISJ. Now, it's not as trivial as you might think. You could think, well, before it was just closed paths, now I just have an open path, right? So you could think that this is, so it's not simply related to this quantity NLIJ beta that we computed. You could think it is, you could think that I already compute the number of paths from 0 to ij. So isn't this precisely what I need for this SISJ? And the answer is not exactly. The winding, when you have this open path, you can easily see that you can have some path where you have naively some winding, but you don't want to put those minus signs. Okay? So you can easily draw some paths. For example, let's draw one path. So this path before for closed guys, right? We said that this, we like to have a minus sign versus this, right? So it was important to have a relative minus sign between these two paths, right? But if I have an open thing, I can draw paths that if I count just left and right turns, I want a sign of one. So I think if I draw like this, versus, so 1, 2, 3, 4, versus this. They go to the same position. One has the same number of left and right turns. So it has, according to our winding formula, it would have no winding. And the other has 4 left turns more than right turns, so it would have winding 1. But we don't want to count them with minus sign, right? This is a configuration of sticks. So we would like, so a naive minus 1 to NL minus NR over 4, which was what we were getting before, is not good here. Because we want both. We don't want to put a minus sign. These paths appear alone. We would like to give weight 1 to them. But right now, if we were to put this formula to weight the paths, one of them would come with minus 1. Right? So we don't want a minus 1 here. It's not something that I would like to have. A relative minus sign between these two paths. Right? These are two configurations of sticks. Each of one comes with weight 1. Right? But right now, if we were to just weight the paths like this, one would come with a relative minus sign. So it is not, so for open paths, we have to be more careful. We do want to exclude some things because we don't want, we do want to exclude some things because things like this, right, comes with one weight, and things like, we don't have, we still have this issue that I don't want, that this is just weight 1, so I do want this plus this plus this to be equal to 1 because it's only one weight. So naively, I do want some winding again to cancel. But it cannot be the trivial one because here I want this to be equal to 1 and this to be equal to 1. I don't want them to get any minus sign there, right? So then it becomes a bit tricky. I mean, in the first example, it looks like I want to put winding. In the second one, it looks not. And we have to work a bit harder, and that's what is done in this section 5.5 of the reference. So you can do it, but you have to think a little bit more about this finding. But I think conceptually it's kind of clear, so I will just quote a few formulas that we can see from this paper, from this work, from the outcome. Okay. So the punchline is, it's not just minus 1 to the winding plus 1, but almost. And therefore, this leads to an expression for SISJ. Okay, so a few results are the following. SISJ, when the distance goes to infinity, and if we are at t smaller than the critical temperature, which means V bigger than VC. By the way, I have a feeling, but I don't remember. I did not have time to watch the video. I have a feeling that in my diagram, when I said V0, V1, and I said one is ferromagnetic, the other is paramagnetic, I kind of have the feeling that I swapped both when I was explaining. What did I say V equals 0 was? Ferromagnetic or paramagnetic?
Ferromagnetic.
Yeah, so it's the opposite, right? V equals 0 is high temperature. It's paramagnetic.
Yeah.
Yeah, please swap them in your notes. I was just thinking now. Okay? Let me make, yeah. Right? So in the diagram we saw was that we have V equals 0 and V equal 1, right? V equal 1 is 0 temperature. V equals 0 is infinite temperature. So infinite temperature is paramagnetic, And V equal 1 is ferromagnetic. It's when we have zero temperature. So here we are at T smaller than Tc, and here T bigger than Tc. And here is V critical, which is 1 square root of 2 minus 1. Yeah, so please fix this. And in one dimension, what happens is that the point goes here. And we only get this second part. We only get, we always flow to the paramagnetic. Right? So this critical temperature goes to V equal 1 in one dimension. Okay? I think I labeled them wrongly in the notes. Okay. Now, when we are below the critical temperature, this goes to a constant. And this constant, we call it m square, because it is m square. It is just the magnetization per side. And so this magnetization per side is not zero, right? So this is not equal to zero. I remind you that this was equal to zero in one dimension, where we said there is no order. But here, above the below the critical temperature, when we are in the ferromagnetic regime, it's not zero. And instead, you can compute this m. And this m, you see, you remember why this is true, right? Because you compute this two-point function. At large distance, it decouples. It becomes average of Si, average of Sj. And so when they decouple, it has the meaning of the magnetization square. And this magnetization, you can compute. And the result you get is 1 plus v square over 16 v to the 4, and then 6 v square minus v to the 4 minus 1, everything to the power 1 over 8. Okay. So that's the result that one gets. And what's interesting is that this quantity is 0 when v is the critical temperature. And so when V approaches the critical temperature, this behaves as V minus V critical to the 1 over 8. In other words, as Tc minus T to the 1 over 8. Okay. And so it says that as I'm approaching the critical temperature, I have a finite magnetization that goes to 0. And we have these kind of typical pictures. That as I am in T, I am above the critical temperature, and I have some magnetization that vanishes, and here it vanishes as a power 1 over 8.
Okay. It should be the other way.
Sorry?
Shouldn't it be the other way, that the magnetization, for low temperature, the magnetization is different than zero?
Yes, it should, yeah. So when T is smaller than Tc, it should be, yeah. Sorry. Precisely, yeah. And so the magnetization vanishes. When T equal to zero, the magnetization is one. And then it vanishes as the power 1/8. I mean, the curve is much more steep because 1 over 8 is very big, very small. So, but that's the general plot. And then you can also ask, well, okay, so it goes to a constant. What about the corrections? What about Si, Sj minus m squared? You subtract x squared. And then you see how it behaves at long distances. And it behaves as some constant e to the minus the separation I minus j divided by xi, so it decays with distance, where xi is logarithm of 1 minus v over 1 plus v times v. And this quantity here behaves as 1 when you are close to VC. Sorry. 1 over log. Right? Size 1 over log. And this argument, we have like 1 plus V minus VC times something plus dot, dot, dot. So the critical exponent, so the correlation length behaves as 1 over T minus TC to the power 1. Right? So the log vanishes when you are close to TC, and the correlation length diverges as we approach. And so we see that there's something quite nice here. So let's see. So we are seeing the behavior, the critical behavior in many quantities. So we are seeing it in the magnetization. The magnetization clearly has a critical behavior. We saw it in the specific heat. And now we see that the correlation functions, they have some typical length, right? Which is the typical length after which they are totally decoupled already. That's the correlation length. That's the definition of correlation length. And the correlation length blows up as T goes to TC, indicating that as T goes to TC, all length scales are important, right? The correlation length becomes larger and larger, right? And that is exactly what we had anticipated based on the analysis of the specific heat, that we were seeing that in the specific heat, we were getting a singularity, a divergent behavior due to long wavelengths. So it was these very long wavelengths that were dominating. And indeed, the correlation length blows up as T goes to TC. So these quantities here, I can write this log of T minus TC. This is basically T minus TC to the zero, right? If you expand in zero, you get one plus log, right? It's formal. And so these kind of numbers that we get here, where by zero I mean it's a log, and this number here, which in this case is a 1. And this number, which in this case is 1 over 8. Right? These boxes, these numbers in these boxes, are what are called critical exponents. Okay? And they tell us how the behavior of a system, how the system is behaving as I'm approaching a critical point. Now, when I'm approaching a critical point, what happens is that when you approach the critical point, the correlation length is very large, right? So effectively, the details of the lattice, whether it was a square lattice, a triangular lattice, whether it was just nearest neighbors or next to nearest neighbors and so on, doesn't matter, right? If the model there was more complicated, again, I would expand a small q and I would get the numbers there, the prefactors could change a bit. But the fact that it's a constant plus something times q squared would be the same. And so these numbers here, these critical exponents, they are the place where we see universality. However, the constants, as I said, do change, right? When we go to microscopic to macroscopic. So not everything is universal. For example, critical temperature, the precise value of the critical temperature is not universal. Depends on the model. So the critical temperature, at what temperature is it? Is it 12 Kelvin, 13 Kelvin, 52 Kelvin? That changes. That depends on the superconductor, or on the magnets, or on the gas. But then, if you are in the same universality class, as you approach the critical temperature, the exponents are the same. Yeah. So the exponents, we compute them for this model and we are getting results for all possible two-dimensional models, all two-dimensionalizing models, they will have the same exponents, but they will have different critical temperatures. Okay? There's one more exponent you could compute, one more quantity you could ask about this, which is, here it is blowing up when T goes to TC. What happens if I go exactly to T equal to TC? Right? And then I compute SISJ at V equal to the critical temperature. Right? notice that from my Ising model point of view, there's nothing problematic. I go to the critical temperature, just means V is 1 minus square root of 2, square root of 2 minus 1, sorry, and I sum over loops, right? So it's okay. It's not like things explode if I do that, right? I just put that value of V and I sum over loops and I get some result. So that's the final formula I want to write, quoting this section 5.5, which is if I am exactly at t equal to tc, the correlation function of si sj behaves as 1 over the separation I minus j to the power 1/4. Okay, so then at that point, the correlation length blows up, so it no longer decays exponentially, but it decays as a power law, and this 1/4 is another critical exponent. This is perhaps the most interesting one, this critical exponent, because it says the following. It says that in the field theory limit, what was a spin Si becomes a field S at position x. So at t equal tc, that's the point where the correlation length is infinity. And therefore, there is no scale in the problem. Right? When t is not equal to tc, there is a typical mass scale, which is the correlation length. And that scale goes away, so that this is at t equal tc, this becomes a critical. This is a critical point where the theory has no scale, and it's what is called a conformal theory, or I will say what it is. It's a conformal field theory. Conformal for us right now, conformal just means that there is no scale, and therefore, because there is no scale, the correlation function of our operators at some position x and some position y, just because there is no scale, I cannot write functions of the distance which are non-trivial. The only thing I can write are power laws. So the only thing the function could be by rotational invariance would be 1 over x minus y to something that would be called the dimension of these fields that conventionally people call sigma. So this would be the dimension of S. Okay. And we see that in our example, the dimension of sigma is equal to 1 over 8. So it says that I have a theory where my fundamental field has dimension 1 over 8. You see, it's a very quantum field. If you think from did you do dimensional analysis of fields in quantum field theory already? Of working out the dimension of the scalar, for example, in D dimensions? No. Okay. But the naive dimension of a field, if you think the field would be, say, let's imagine a free field. Tell me if the following words are okay for you. That the Lagrangian for a free field would be just the integral of del phi square. Is this okay? It's just the integral of the derivative of phi square. And so it's the derivative of the field square. We integrate over space. So we have d2x and two derivatives. So concerning dimensions, I have no dimensions. And so the scalar would have dimension 0. So that's the classical dimension of a scalar in two dimensions. So if the theory is free, it has dimension 0. And here it has dimension 1 over 8 instead of 0. So we can say that 1 over 8 instead of 0, it's because the theory is very quantum. It's strongly coupled. There's no weak coupling parameter. And the fact that it is 1 over 8, it's 1 over 8 instead of 0, it's precisely because the theory is very quantum. So you can say that if we start with a free scalar, doesn't interact, Then we turn on interactions that lead to the Ising model. The theory flows and becomes very strongly coupled. And it's this strongly coupled, it's this strong coupling that gives this 1 over 8. It's a very strong effect. Naively, we would expect dimension 0. Yes?
Sorry, can you not always extract the dimensions of the field from the kinetic term? So I don't understand how adding couplings changes the dimension.
You cannot. You cannot. So the question is, can I just extract the dimensions of field from Lagrangians? No, only when the theory is weakly coupled.
So if
yes.
the dimension is smaller, then you have more quantum effects?
The bigger is the deviation from the classical guess, which is the guess from the Lagrangian, the bigger the quantum effects are.
How do we get those effects?
We computed, right? In this case, we solved the model.
You say that it means it's more strongly correlated. I don't really see how that statement kind of comes out of what we calculated.
So if you have a conformal field theory which is almost weakly coupled, what does it mean? It means that it's free plus corrections, and there is a parameter that controls the corrections. Then your dimensions will be the classical value from the Lagrangian plus order lambda, where lambda is the parameter that controls the corrections. And then you would have a perturbation theory parameter that you expand. And your dimension will be 0 plus lambda times 5 plus lambda squared times 7 plus whatever, right? And so it will be arbitrarily close to free. But here, right away, it's 1 over 8. It's not 0 plus something small plus something small plus something. No, it's 1 over 8. So it's really far from free theory. If it was 3, it would be further. But 1 over 8 is already far from 0. It's finite distance away from 0. It's disconnected. It's not smoothly connected. It's not almost free, the theory. It's very far from free. Okay. So just for comparison, right? So we got this 1 over 4. Okay. But just to make this point of strongly coupled, so let's take for comparison, let's take our propagator that we had in the Gaussian model. Right? And the propagator in the Gaussian model was some integral d2q over 2 pi square e to the iqr over q square plus m square, or let's do the same notation, plus 1 over xi square. And you could ask what happens when xi equal to infinity, right? That's the analog. If you want to study at the critical temperature, it would be when the correlation length blows up. So if psi equal infinity, we get this integral with 1 over q squared, and that behaves as some constant times logarithm of r. You can easily see that what happens is that when this is 0, you need to regulate, because when q goes to 0, this is q dq over q squared, so it blows up for very small q, right? So you regulate. In other words, you go back to the sum that we had before. So that says that there is a small cutoff. The cutoff is the lattice spacing, right? Because you cannot go all the way to 0. And therefore, the integral gives the cutoff. The natural cutoff is 1 over q. The integral is 1 over q. So it gives a log. And you get exactly log of r, or r over the lattice spacing, if you want. But this is just a statement of an integral. But you see that this is indeed what we are saying, that it's basically, right, separation r to the 0, right? In that sense of when we have a log, we think as power 0. So in that sense, this is it's very far away from a power 1 over 4, right? There's nothing to do. So in that sense, this is what we expect by what I said, that the correlation function has length 0, right? And this is what we see. It's a very quantum effect, very far from 0. Right? So instead of this 0 here, we are getting this So it's very quantum. Or in the language of paths, the constraint that we are this winding is a strong effect, right? It's not something small that because I put this line. Yeah, by the way, okay, sorry, go ahead.
How do we know that that's very far away? Like, what is very far away?
Anything that is not parametrically close. Everything that there is no expansion parameter, it's not zero. It would be close to zero if it was lambda plus lambda squared plus lambda cubed, if there was a parameter of expansion around to zero. It's just disconnected, right? I mean, 1/4, in no sense, is zero, right? It's here it's zero, here it's 1/4. They are not close. I cannot touch one from the other. Okay. Of course, we could ask. Right? We could, about this interpolation, we could ask the question, is there a model with where I replace minus 1 to the winding plus 1, which was mu to the omega, which was minus mu to the omega, where mu was e to the I pi over 4. And can we have a model where instead of this, we use mu generic, and then mu equal 1 or mu equal e to the I pi over 4 would be the usual walk and the Isaac model, and it would be fun to see what happens when I interpolate this, right? Because mu equal 1, I don't count winding, mu equal e to the I pi over 4, I count winding, where we use mu generic to interpolate, right? That's a good question, yeah, I don't know the answer.
Wouldn't we have stuff like this if we try to use, for example, the Isaac model on a triangular lattice, where we would have like turns of different angles?
In the triangular lattice, but it would still be a fixed number. It would still be it's I pi over 3 or it's I pi over 6. Yeah, so it's true, it's a different mu, but it's still a fixed mu. I want the model would interpolate where mu goes from 1 to e to the I pi over 4. And if we would have that model, I could perhaps define that model, but I don't know if it makes sense, the definition. We would have to make sure that 1, it makes sense for the partition function, and 2, it makes sense for the correlation functions, where I said the combinatorics was a little bit more subtle. If we could make sense of both, we would perhaps get a model where mu would interpolate between the two, right? Because here we have mu equal e to the I pi over 4. Here we have mu equal to 1, right? We don't put windings in the random walk, and perhaps if we keep mu generic, we could interpolate. I mean, it's very naive. For example, very naively, in our matrix 4x4, we could put mu instead of e to the I pi over 4, right? And just recompute that determinant 4x4, see what we get, and we could play with this. But I'm not sure if it will make much sense. Perhaps it would. Okay. So those were some comments I wanted to make. There are a few more comments. So by the way, all these critical exponents, they have names. So this 1/4 is eta, that 0 is alpha. There are names for them. So if you go to books, people emphasize a lot these names, alpha, beta, whatever. But for me, I don't care much. So it is just whatever governs the power law. OK. Because I'm here, this is alpha. Okay. So the second comment I would like to make is the following. So we saw that our z was equal to something and then sum over loops. Sum over loops of some factor v to the length of the loops times 1, where V was tangent of J, in other words, 1 minus e to the minus 2j divided by 1 plus e to the 2j. Now, notice that, on the other hand, there is another way of explaining why Z is a sum of loops that doesn't use sticks at all, which was what you saw in the homework. So, because on Friday you had the homework, I assume everyone saw this part, which is, if I just say that I sum in my original spins and I put who is plus spin and who is minus spin, let me put the plus spin, this means plus 1 and empty. Empty would be minus 1. And if I put if I consider my configurations and I label them by who is plus and who is minus, I see that I can draw loops that separate who is plus and who is minus. And moreover, by looking at these loops, I reconstruct the configuration. Because I say inside this plus, whenever I have a dashed line, I change the sign of the spin. And so there is as much, so these loops are enough to reconstruct the spins. They have the same information. I just know that I have a loop separating plus sign from minus sign. In particular, we could have a loop, for example, there could be, imagine I have a configuration like this. That means that, for example, I have plus here, then minus, plus. I could have loops inside loops inside loops, and all this would be loops of the model. And so, immediately from this picture, we also have a summation over loops, if I want to sum over configurations. Now, this picture here was useful for low t, in other words, for high t, which is v very small. Because here, small loops dominate. Right? Small loops dominate, loops of type 4, then loops of type 6, 8, and so on. Right? Now, this picture here would be relevant if instead, so this picture would be best for beta large, in other words, t going to 0, so low temperature. Because when you are at beta very large, all spins want to point in the same direction, right? And therefore, what we want is to have all spins up, say, except a few islands of spins minus, right? And so we would conclude that my partition function is equal. If everyone is up, it would give me e to the j, everyone is up, so e to the j, and this would happen l squared times. So this would be everyone up. So actually there is a 2, let me explain in a second. So all spins up. So if there are l squared points, each point has 4 connections. Right? And so the total number of links, is twice the number of points. Right? It will be 4 times, but I don't want to overcount, so it's twice. Is it clear?
Yeah.
Number of links is 5, so it's 2j l squared. That's the number of links. By the way, that also explains, you know, well, I did not like this over 2. Yeah, that's why there's no over 2 here. Right? Number of connections is L squared, is 2, is L squared. It's 2 L squared. It's not L squared. So here it's over 2 times 2. It's 2 L squared, and here 2. Okay? So it was, there was a typo there, right? That was number of connections. And the number of connections is 5. So
I think that the two is 2 D L squared, because the 2 comes from every vertex, and there is L squared vertices. Right, the 1 minus b squared comes from taking a cosine, a hyperbolic cosine from each edge, and the 2 comes from...
No, for each edge, I did this. And how many edges there are? 2 L squared.
Uh-huh.
That's it, right? So it's this factor to the power 2 L squared. And this factor, on the other hand, was 1 minus b squared to the minus 1/2.
Yeah, no, but I mean the 1 minus b squared comes from that taking out of that number, but the 2 comes from averaging the SIs, right?
No, these 2, you mean?
That 2 comes from the integration,
yeah,
of the SIs, right? And that gives a 2 per vertex.
So it should be L squared.
So it should be 2 to the L squared.
2 L squared.
Ah, these 2 here, probably, all right, yeah. Thank you. Okay. So all spins up will give me this factor. And then whenever I have some island of spins down, the energy is just related to the energy of the boundary. Because inside, all up or all minus is the same, right? When you have 2 spins up or 2 spins down, SI, SJ is the same. So it's all about the boundary. And so I get immediately sum over loops. And then I get V tilde to the L times 1, where V tilde is length is the boundary, the length of the boundary, and V tilde is, of course, just e to the minus j. Okay. Do you agree? So what we are doing here is just noticing that e to the, I always put beta, but si, sj, right, is e to the j, if both are 1, times e to the j, si, sj, actually it's good that we did this exercise carefully. So if both are 1, it's just this factor, and when they are opposite, it gives e to the minus 2 beta j. So this is actually it. So this factor, it's 1 when si equal to sj, and it's e to the minus 2j when si is not equal to sj. So this is what it is inside a loop or outside. Outside or inside loop, and that's what we get at the boundary of the loop. And so at each link here costs e to the minus 2j. Right? Each link across my boundary. Right? So this is just another normalization like that, another normalization tilde. But then what we conclude, it's very nice, is that I have 2 sums over loops. One with V, where V is given by this, and another one with V tilde, where V tilde is given by this. So this is what's called the low temperature expansion, the high temperature expansion. And this is what's called the low temperature expansion. And the high temperature duality of the Ising model is the statement that at high temperature and low temperature, the models look the same. It looks in both cases just a sum over loops. Right? But now, you see, you could say, suppose there is a critical point. And let's imagine that there is only one critical point somewhere. We know where it is because we already computed. But if we assume, so assume there exists a unique, how is it? It's a dot? Unique? There exists and it's unique? Is it like this? There exists a unique?
Exists exclamation mark.
Okay. This is my new unique. See, it's very unique. There exists a unique critical point. Right? So then it must be the same. Then whatever critical point I find from here must be the same critical point I find from summing over these loops. And therefore, I conclude that if it exists, then V tilde critical must be equal to my V critical, which if I translate in terms of J means, or if I write in the following way, I write that if it happens at the same position, it means that e to the minus 2 times j critical is equal to 1 minus e to the minus 2 j critical divided by 1 minus e to the 2 plus 2 j critical. Right? Because if there is a single critical point V star, then it must be the same in both, but they are not independent, they are related by this duality. And we would get this equation, which leads precisely to V critical equal to 1 minus square root of 2. And so we would see that the critical temperature that we found here through this careful analysis had to be square root of 2 minus 1, sorry. Had to be square root of 2 minus 1. It couldn't be something else. It's determined by the condition that there is a single critical temperature, then it must be the same from both expansions. So if it exists, it must be a point where this is true, and therefore this leads to this critical temperature. Yes?
There are many different structures for lattice, right? I think it is only because we are considering the square lattice, so the duality for it.
Yes. Okay. So let's. A good point. So the so here. So indeed, the fact that there was a duality, right? This low t being dual to high t was for the square lattice. Right? Because for the square lattice, the original lattice and the dual lattice are the same. Notice that here, what we did is go to the dual lattice. Why did we go to the dual lattice? Because for each point of the face, now it became a new point that is perpendicular, right? So we found the edges are now perpendicular to the previous edges. That's the definition of dual lattice, right? What was before an edge now is pierced by an edge. So that's what's the definition of dual lattice. So what was a face now becomes a vertex. And what is a vertex now becomes a face in the new lattice, right? And here the dual lattice is still a square lattice, right? It's just shifted by a little bit. But we could ask in other lattices. But before, let me emphasize, do you guys agree that this fixes the critical temperature, right? This is what you saw in the homework. And in particular, there was a statement, there is a statement then, that if I'm close to the critical temperature, slightly to the left or slightly to the right, it doesn't matter. Because there is a duality, going to high temperature or going to low temperature. And therefore, the result around the critical temperature should be even. And that was why I knew that there was no linear term there. And V minus V critical, there should be no linear term in V minus V critical. That's why it starts with square. Right? So it had to start with square. And this square means that it's even around this point. It's a consequence of high temperature, low temperature duality. And the fact that around that point, things must be symmetric. Okay. So let's do a simple exercise, which is to say, what about say, triangular lattice. First of all, let me emphasize that you do know how to solve the 2D Ising model in any lattice, right? If you think a little bit, what would be the difference? I would have loops, again. I would take into account the winding, but now the winding, instead of e to the I pi over 4, I put some correct e to the I pi over 3 or over 6, depending on what lattice it is, right? Depending on what are the angles. Instead of having, if it is, say, a triangular lattice, right? Triangular lattice. When you reach a point, you have six directions where you come from, right? Instead of just four directions, you would have six possibilities of entering there. So you would have a 6x6 matrix instead of 4x4, because now beta would be one of these six directions, right? The angles, instead of e to the I pi over 4, would be e to the I pi over 6, because there would be more options now for this winding, right? You would have to put some winding factors. So you generalize a little bit, right? So from 4x4 transfer matrix with a bunch of I pi over 4, you would go to some 6x6 transfer matrix with some angles I pi over 6, right? And you would just write a similar determinant. You would compute the determinant, and the determinant would change a little bit, right? So it becomes a determinant, changes into a determinant of a 6x6 matrix, and you will get a slightly different result for that lattice, right? And you could do it for also for the hexagonal lattice, for example, or the honeycomb lattice, where I have like the honeycomb. What would be the size of the matrix in the honeycomb? Now it would be 3, because there are 3 options, right? So in the honeycomb, it would be a bit smaller, and there will be different types of angles, right? But then I could end at this lattice point or this lattice point, so on the other hand. So it would be the probability of ending on this type of point or this type of point. You would see that you would have to distinguish both. So it ends up being 6x6 again. But you can also solve it. Okay? So we know how to solve these models. We could find its critical temperature. You could solve them and find the critical temperature again. You just write some similar expression like this. And you see what is the value of the critical temperature where this log is 0. Right? But instead, let's predict these critical temperatures for these models. Or let's see how we would predict. So the idea is that here, right, we have sum over sticks. Right? So we have our summation over sticks. We just expand and we have sticks. But on the other hand, that's the high temperature expansion. What about the low temperature expansion? In the low temperature, I separate plus from minus. So let's separate plus from minus. So I separate plus from minus. So let me draw the region that separates. And the region that we get is that in this case, for example, this would be what we would have. And more generically, if you draw a line perpendicular to each line of this lattice, so to each line, to each vertex, to each face you put a vertex, each face you put a vertex, and then to each edge you associate a dashed line, you see what lattice do we get? We have the triangular lattice. And what do we have? On the triangular lattice, I have a sum over loops, right? So what we conclude is that there is a duality that says that the partition function of the 2D Ising model in the hexagonal lattice right, in the hexagonal lattice. It's related to the partition function. By partition function, we mean in this language that we sum over. The partition function of the 2D Ising model is related to the partition function of the 2D Ising model on the triangular lattice. Because under thinking, if we think from a low in the original lattice, we have paths like this, like we had paths, we had a sum over paths. If we think from sticks, we have this type of sum over loops, right? So that's in the picture of sticks. On the other hand, we get this type of blue loops if we think from the picture of low temperature domains. Domains, vacuum domains separated by a boundary. So this is what we get if we start from the hexagonal lattice. But if we start from the triangular lattice, it would be the other way around. This would be what we would get. So this is if we start from hexagon. But if we start from triangle, we would get immediately this picture here. And then this picture would be low T domains if I start from the triangular lattice. So here, we cannot fix the critical temperature right now, because all we said was that if I have my 2D Ising model, I relate in the triangular lattice at low temperature, I relate to the hexagon at high temperature. So this is a duality. It's not a self-duality. It's not a duality that relates the model to itself. It relates to different models. Triangle and hexagonal lattice, right? So let's write an equation. So if I have two-dimensionalizing model with parameter, let's call this mu that we define as e to the minus 2j, we conclude that we get the same Ising model, but where instead of mu, we have 1 minus mu over 1 plus mu. Right? If mu has that definition. So if it was in the square lattice, more general, what you get is always this relation. If here I replace this by a lattice, here I replace this by the dual lattice. And when the dual lattice is equal to the lattice, and if I assume there's only one critical point, I equate mu on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side, and I get the critical temperature, right? So that's what we did before, right? So before, the square lattice was equal to the dual lattice, and therefore mu critical was the solution, mu critical equal 1 minus mu critical over 1 plus mu critical, and that led to the square root of 2 minus 1 for V. But now, we don't have a critical temperature, we just have a duality. It's nice. We learned that the triangular lattice and the hexagonal lattice are related by duality, but this doesn't fix the critical temperature. Okay. But actually, we can go around that, and we can work a little bit harder and fix the critical temperature. Once we realize the following, let's suppose I have the hexagonal lattice. Let's take this hexagonal lattice. And let's consider let's put the spins. Let's call this circles. And let me call this crosses. Okay, these guys will be circles again. Okay. And the question is, what we can do here is we can integrate out the circles. We can do explicitly the sum over the circles. Okay. So let's work this out, and that's due to the very simple statement that. Okay. So let's try. So we are saying that the summation over some spin of some circle, and then I have e to the j times the spin of the circle times the summation over the neighbors of the circle, j, 1, 2, or 3, of the crosses, j. Okay, so I take this circle, and I want to integrate it out, so to sum over 1, 2, 3 of the interaction, this guy with this, this guy with this, this guy with this. Now, this is trivial, right? It is just twice cosh of j times the sum over j as x, comma j. And what values can that sum take? What values can that sum take? Good, good. 3, 1, minus 1, minus 3. And therefore, what values can the cosh take? How many values can the cosh take? Not 4, because cosh is even. 2. So this only takes 2 values. Right? So this guy is just 1 plus minus 1 or plus minus 3. And therefore, this takes 2 values only. And therefore, I can write this as a e to the beta as 1 s2 plus s1 s3 plus s2 s3. Because this expression also only takes 2 values. And you can see that if all spins are the same, that exponential becomes e to the 3b. And if one spin is different, which is the other option, that exponential gives e to the beta. And so by equating, let's call this not beta, let's call this j tilde. And therefore, we can easily find j tilde in function of j. So I just compute the ratio, and I get e to the 2j tilde. Here I computed the ratio of 3 spins up versus 1 spin down, and I compare with the previous line, so it's cosh of 3j over cosh of j. Do you agree? So I just computed the ratio of that expression with 3 spins up and 2 up, 1 down, and I get this ratio, it's equal to this. But then, now, we recognize something nice. We recognize that what we get here is just an interaction between these triangles. And so I integrated out and I generated some j tilde interaction here. And therefore, what lattice do I end up with? Right? I end up with a triangular lattice. So this is what's called the star triangle relation. It's the fact that when I have this star, I can eliminate it and get the triangle. Okay? And this duality disintegrating out, this is what's called the star triangle. The star triangle relation, and it relates the hexagonal lattice. I integrate out and I get a triangular lattice. Okay? And in equations, if you want, you can say that Z hexagonal lattice of coupling mu, I'm using the same notation as there, the same definition as there, with n points is equal to the partition function of the triangular lattice with n over 2 points. Mu is given by this inverse of this. It this is true, so e to the minus j is just the inverse of this. And the inverse of this is equal to, so I invert, and then I write this cautious in terms of mu's. So let me do it, and you check if I'm doing a mistake or not. So I inverted, and I get here 1 plus mu over 1 plus mu squared. Times some power of A, right? A to the number of links. A to how many links there are. So per each square, I did this trick n times. Yeah, n over 2. But this is just a constant. What matters is that I went from hexagonal honeycomb to triangular lattice. And now I can close the system because triangular was equal to honeycomb, but honeycomb is related to triangular again. And therefore, now if I assume that triangular only has one critical point, I can find the critical point of triangle. So for the triangular lattice, now we can equate, we can use this, the first duality and the second duality to say that the critical position is when 1 minus mu over 1 plus mu is equal to 1 plus mu over 1 plus mu squared. I put the C for critical, and this will give me the critical temperature of the triangular lattice.
Is there some sort of tetrahedron relation in higher D?
There are such relations in higher D, yeah. Not exactly tetrahedron. You see that here what was crucial, technically, what was crucial is that there were only 2 values. And in higher D, typically, you will not have only 2 values. So integrating out, typically, even in the square lattice, this game doesn't work. I cannot integrate out half of the spins. Because if the sum was up to 4, not up to 3, I would have more options. All spins could be plus, that's 4. 2 could be plus, 2 could be minus, that's 0. Or 3 could be plus and 1 could be minus, that's 1. So I have 3 options. So already, it doesn't work for the square lattice. I cannot just integrate out half of the spins because I have 3 values and not 2. So what does it mean? It means that when I integrate out, I get back a square lattice, but with more interactions, with nearest neighbor interactions. And then if I continue integrating out, I generate more and more interactions, and it's a mess. It is here that because of the fact that there are only 3 neighbors, that we can integrate out and don't generate new terms. Okay? And this will give me the critical temperature of the triangular lattice. So that's how we would go about solving this issue that the lattice is not the same for the triangular lattice. And it's a nice exercise to compute, repeat this exercise of the two-dimensional model and get that this, indeed, you get a critical temperature precisely compatible with this solution. Okay? So here, we use that Z triangular was equal to Z hexagonal by low temperature, high temperature duality. So this is T duality. And then on the other hand, this was equal to Z of triangular by decimation. In other words, by integrating out some spins by star triangle identity. So here we are combining the kind of things we were doing in the beginning of integrating out spins to generate an effective interaction. But the effective interaction here changes the lattice from hexagonal to triangular. The triangular was equal to hexagonal by duality, so the triangular is given by triangular at a different coupling. But if there is only one critical point, it must be the same in left and right hand side, and that leads to this equation. Is it okay? And that's how we would go about finding this temperature. Let me mention also that this relation, that the partition function, this high temperature, low temperature dualities, these high temperature, low temperature dualities are exact dualities. And therefore they say that if I compute this sum over loops, it's equal to this sum over loops. Exactly, right? Up to some simple prefactors. But we can go and remember that this was exact. If you want to really make it exact, just replace this by sum over Brill and so on. Then there's no approximation, right? And so it must be that you take this expression, you replace V by the dual V, and the expression must come back to itself exactly, not approximately. It's not just about finding the critical temperature. And indeed, this is what you saw also in the homework, or what you are going to see, that this expression, I replace V by the dual V, and this full thing combined with this prefactor, if all the factors of two are correctly put, and this is a check, then they recombine some, after you do V to 1 over V, you give some constant to this part. This constant reorganizes to give exactly the new constant. I start with some hashtag, I do the duality, I get another hashtag tilde, and the two work out perfectly, and the duality is exact. Partition function with V is partition function with V tilde. It is indeed a property of this partition function, right? So it has exact duality. So here we can use it. It obeys the duality. Not only the critical temperature is okay, but the full duality is okay, right? So the critical temperature, it's nice that we find exactly what we expect, but it's not just the critical temperature. We find that the partition function at V and at the dual point, which is 1 minus V over 1 plus V, is exactly the same. Okay? Okay. So finally, let me conclude this last 10 minutes. With recalling a difference between 1D and 2D. So in 1D, we had M equal to 0, right? Whatever, no matter what T we get. And we said that kinks destroy magnetic order, right? We blamed it on the kinks. Right? And the idea was that the entropy, was big, but the energy was finite, right? Because the energy of a kink and t-kink is just at the boundary, so it's order one, but the entropy is very big because we can put the kinks and t-kinks at many positions with many sizes. So the entropy grows and the energy is finite, and therefore the entropy wins. And thus, we want to put many kinks and anti-kinks in all possible positions, and therefore we cannot have an average magnetization. Right? Do you agree? That was the argument. But here, in 2D, we saw that this is not the case, that there is some magnetization, and so we have some magnetization for T smaller than some critical temperature. And therefore, the same analysis should not change. Okay? So let's work out this analysis. So let's repeat this argument for the kinks and anti-kinks to see what would happen. So now the energy, right, of the energy is proportional to J times L, where L is the length of the domain. So now I'm thinking in this high temperature, low temperature domain. Right? So we have some domains where here it's spin up, spin is spin minus, and the energy is proportional to, is exactly equal to twice J times the length, J per length. Right? So that's for length of a domain, length of the domain. So L is the length of the domain. Now, what is the entropy? What is the entropy for that length L, which is how many ways there are of putting this, right? Of making a closed loop. Okay. So this guy would be log of the number of closed loops of length L. That way I could estimate and say, let's say it's some mu to some power L. Now, indeed, we can, for example, immediately estimate mu. We can say, for example, right away that I don't know what mu is, but I know that mu is smaller than 3. Because 3 is, for our paths, is how many ways, how many options I have after giving one path. I cannot go back, so I go one path, and then I have 3 options, right? So 3 to the L is the number of paths where at each step I don't go back, right? So 3 to the L equal to the number of paths of length L where going and coming back is forbidden, right? So at each step, I just choose one option, two options, or 3 options. So definitely the number of closed paths is smaller than 3 to the L. I need to come back to the same position. But on the other hand, mu is bigger than log 2 over 4. This one is funnier to explain. So this one is obvious. This one is more interesting. So how do we work out this? How do we say that mu is bigger than log 2 over 4? We construct explicitly log 2 over 4 to the L paths that are closed. So how can we construct these paths that are closed, that are definitely a subset of the closed paths? We say that just start with a path that either goes left or up only. So start with a path that goes left or up only for L over 4 steps. So L over 4 steps, you just go up, all right? Right? And then all you do is you take this path. Okay, now it doesn't fit, but you just repeat it here, here, and here to make a closed path. See, all I did is I copy-paste this and rotate, and I put this here, here, and here. Huh? I just took this, put here, and it's a closed path, right? So how many paths are there? Well, I made 2 choices, L over 4 times, so the number of such paths is 2 options, L over 4 times. Which is exactly e to the L times log 2 over 4. Those are definitely closed paths. So the number of closed paths is definitely bigger than this, because these are only some closed paths, and it's smaller than 3. So mu is some number between these 2 values, and it exists. Right? Therefore, we bracketed this number of legs. We show that it's exponentially large with mu somewhere between these 2 values. And so, we conclude that the entropy is given by L log mu with mu somewhere here. And so, when we compute energy minus 1 over temperature times entropy, both scale with L, right? Both scale with L. And so we see that energy wins. Energy dominates if T is smaller. If T is smaller than some critical temperature, and the entropy wins if T is bigger than some critical temperature. Where this critical temperature is what? If we try to estimate, let's try to estimate a little bit better. Let's put a 2 here, where this critical temperature is something like 2J over log mu. Right? Approximately equal to 2J over log mu. And so there is a critical temperature where the entropy, where the energy is winning. And when the energy wins, we want to create big boxes, big domains of plus sign. And when the entropy wins, we prefer to, inside a big domain, put more domains because entropy wins, and then we destroy magnetic order. So do we want to destroy or not magnetic order? Depends if we are above or below the critical temperature. Above some critical temperature, we expect to have no order. Below, we expect to have order. And that's indeed precisely what we observe. Okay? And so the analysis is that in D equal 1, we have no order. And in D equals 2, we can have order. And in D bigger than 2, we can, the same analysis would say the same thing, that we can have order if we have a system, if we have this. Now here, let's see what was important and what was not important. So here what was important was that we have some system which is local, right? And where the number of degrees of freedom was discrete, where we have some discrete number of degrees, like spin up, spin down. Now, what would change in the analysis if instead of spin up and spin down, if it was like 3 values that the spin could take instead of 2? Nothing special. It would be the same thing. It's all about the boundary grows, the energy of a boundary grows with the length, and the entropy is related to something that also grows with the length. So in fact, these conclusions, even though we had the Ising model in mind, this is true whenever we have some discrete symmetry. Because for a discrete symmetry, the boundary, the energy, goes like the length of the boundary. Because at the boundary, you separate two states, that is like A and B, and the energy is delta AB, the difference of energy between A and B. So it's some finite number. OK? Length of the boundary times delta E, the energy, let's put energy, is the length of the boundary times delta E, where delta E is the energy, the difference of energy between vacuum A and vacuum B. Doesn't matter if it's up or down, or if it's a gas and then it's empty or full, if it's a disk, if you put a particle at each point, or if it's 3 values of the spin. It doesn't matter. What matters is that there is some energy of A, some energy at B, and some difference of energy that is proportional then to the boundary. And the boundary, if it's kinks, it's just 2 values. If it's 2 dimensions, it's proportional to the length. 3 dimensional, proportional to the area, and so on. And therefore, these considerations would be very general, that whenever you have a discrete symmetry, you can never have order in one dimension, and you can have in 2 dimensions or in higher dimensions. It's not true just for the Ising model. Okay? And I'm emphasizing this because things would change if we have a continuous symmetry. Let me just say the result without proof, and next time I will start here. Now, what happens if we have continuous symmetry? Continuous symmetry, what would be an example? Would be when we have, say, the ON model. In the ON model, I don't have spin up or down. I can smoothly, I have ON, I have a continuous group, and I can smoothly go from minus to plus. Right? So a continuous symmetry would be like the ON model. Right? And here a discrete symmetry like the Z2 Ising model. I added Z2 to emphasize that there is this Z2 symmetry up and down. And here it's ON model, where I have my vector, and I can rotate it a little bit, and then rotate it a little bit, and I can do it smoothly. Because what changes now if I can change smoothly? I could still imagine that I have a vacuum where all spins are pointing like this. And here I can have another vacuum where all spins are pointing in another direction. And I could still separate them by lines. And therefore, the entropy would be more or less the same. But the energy would change dramatically, because now I can change the energy smoothly. I don't need to change it abruptly. So we could ask, could I change the energy smoothly? And can it be that the energy here, So can it be that the delta energy for the continuum case, can it be much smaller than the delta energy for the discrete state? Because we change smoothly. So when you change smoothly, you see that whenever the spins are pointing more or less in the same direction, it doesn't cost any energy. So if you change smoothly, you could imagine I have a domain of all spins pointing up. Here I have a domain where they are pointing 45 degrees. And there is a domain wall where they change from one to the other smoothly. And because they change smoothly, this is huge. This is L. This is also huge, L prime. This is L. It's much bigger than one, but much smaller than each of them. So it could be like 20, over 20 sites I change smoothly, and it costs very little energy. And indeed, that's what happens. So this is indeed what happens. And therefore, when we do it for continuous symmetries, the conclusion, which is also universal, is that in one dimension, we still have no order, of course, because this can only destroy more order. And now, in two dimensions, we can also have no order. And in higher dimensions, we can have order. And so this is the general picture of whether we can have order or not in statistical mechanical problems. When we have discrete symmetries, we did the analysis, we got this. When we have continuous symmetries, it turns out that the energy is such that the entropy always wins in two dimensions, because it doesn't cost much to change a domain from up to minus. You can slowly rotate, and it doesn't cost much. Okay? And therefore here, so here, by having no order, I remind you, it means that entropy wins. So entropy wins in 1D always, and it also wins in 2D when we have a continuous symmetry. So when we have the ON model, for example, even though you could say that energetically the spins might want to be all in the same direction, in 2D, they don't order. They don't align all in the same direction. And they don't align all in the same direction because it's preferably to change them smoothly, if you can change them smoothly. But in the Ising model, they do align all in the same direction because there is a competition. So if you are below the critical temperature, they do align like we saw. Right? The magnetization is indeed non-zero. Okay? So this is a very important, table. And again, I want to emphasize that the first line we derived it, but not the second. So next time, I will say a few words about the second line. But this is really an important picture to have in mind, because it immediately teaches us a lot about any material, whether can we have order, can we not have order. This is a very important table to know about. Okay? Okay, so I think, let me just see. Yeah. Okay, so next time I will summarize this table, say a few more words about order and not order, and we will move to the last topic, which are the self-avoiding walks. Yeah, self-avoiding walks. Okay.